Alina Kako. Greetings, everyone. My name is Kehaulani Kawanui, and I'm your host on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. This program features the political and cultural struggles and resistance of Indigenous peoples. The show is produced in the studios of WESU in Middletown, Connecticut. This location is also known as Mattabesset, the traditional homeland of the Wangunk Indian tribe. From wherever you are listening, I can receive emails with your feedback on the program. Write to me at indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. And for those wanting to catch up on past episodes, check out the program archives online at indigenouspolitics.com. On today's show, I'll be featuring two presentations from a Native sovereignty panel that was held at the recent Rebellious Lawyering Conference at Yale Law School. As some of you may have heard, on the last episode, I played one of three presentations from the panel. The title of the panel is Sovereignty and Survival, Indigenous Perspectives on Federal Law and Policy. And today I play two more from the panel, one made by David Cornsilk and the other by me. I want to acknowledge that the panel was organized by Katie McKay Bryson of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College. The framework for the panel was as follows. Quote, the majority of law students are unlikely to pursue a career practicing law in Indian country. Yet everyone who helps author, pass, or practice U.S. law and policy will interact with the integral idea that indigenous peoples of this continent are sovereign communities. This panel strives to bring clarity to what that sovereignty means, both as an abstract idea and as a concrete reality shaping people's lives. And as speakers, we were all asked to address the complex realities of sovereignty, including the cultural context from which it arises, and the vital resistance and forms of survival it nourishes. I'll play David Cornsilk's presentation followed by my own. Let me tell you more about him. Cornsilk is a registered member of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma and enrolled citizen of the United Kituwa Band of Cherokee Indians. He was the co-founder and managing editor of the independent newspaper The Cherokee Observer and one of the founders of the Cherokee National Party. His lifelong activism included working to expose the problem of Indian art fraud in eastern Oklahoma, co-founding the White Path Foundation, which was the first organization to publish information on HIV/AIDS in the Cherokee language, supporting equal marriage rights for gay, lesbian, and two-spirit Cherokee citizens, and passionate advocacy for Cherokee freedmen citizenship, including a successful suit on their behalf in the Cherokee Nation Supreme Court. And some of you longtime listeners of Indigenous Politics Radio may recall that I interviewed David Cornsilk back in 2007 about the Cherokee freedmen citizenship case. This is a good opportunity to get a full update of what's happened in the last 5 years, as the case has unfolded continuously since then.
Okay. Dewe Unanute, Ali Heliga, Ani Mohigani, Ani Pipati, Ali Helisti, Astinaheyu Unesana. I'm so happy to be here. I'm proud that you guys have had us here. And I would also like to echo what he said and thank the Mohawk and Pequot people for letting us be on their land. And also thank you to you, as the occupiers of this land, we're glad that you've allowed us to be here as well. My name is David Cornsilk, and I grew up in the Cherokee Nation. Many people will ask me, what is your degree of blood? How much Indian are you? Because I know that I'm fair. I can look in the mirror at myself and see that I'm fair. And so people ask me that, and my response is, how much do I have to be? How much do you require before you will accept me as an Indian? That gets me to the point at which I would like to speak to you about, and that is the Cherokee Freedmen. The Cherokee Freedmen is a sovereignty issue. It is an issue of how indigenous nations deal with members of their tribe, who they accept as parts of their tribe. I have a very wide encompassing view of citizenship. I probably am more like an American in that sense, in that America was, give me your poor, give me your tired, give me your wretched masses, and that's how you all got here. Well, I see that, the Cherokee Nation, in much the same way. The Cherokee Nation has been a multi-ethnic political entity from almost the very first days of the formation of the Republic of the United States. In fact, the very first treaty that was made with the Cherokee Nation, the Cherokees were already a multi-ethnic polity. They had adopted non-Indians who had married into the Cherokee Nation. These men were called countrymen. They had absolute rights of any other Cherokee in the nation. They could vote. They could run for office. They were a part of the tribe.
And in 1775, the Cherokees adopted their first black person into the nation, a young black girl named Molly. Molly was a slave in southern Georgia. The man who brought her into the Cherokee Nation brought her in exchange for a life he had taken. The Cherokees believed in clan revenge, or as the Bible would say, an eye for an eye. And so he killed his wife, his Cherokee wife, and her clan was out to get him. And so he fled down to southern Georgia, purchased a little 14-year-old black girl, brought her into the Cherokee Nation, and said, "Please take this child in exchange for the life I have taken." And the Deer clan met, discussed it, and said, "We'll take her." And so they adopted her, and they dressed her in ceremonial dress, and they gave her a Cherokee name called Jigeyu, which in Cherokee means beloved. And they adored her, and she was a part of the tribe, and she grew up to marry a Cherokee, and all of her children were Cherokee. And we would not know anything about Molly except for the fact that in 1833, the white woman that Mr. Dent, who had purchased her from, he actually didn't pay for her. He took her. And so this woman comes into the Cherokee Nation demanding this woman as her slave. She said, "This woman is my slave, and you owe her back to me. But not only do you owe her back to me, but under Georgia law, you also owe me her children and grandchildren. They are my property." And so a lawsuit was brought, and in the Cherokee Supreme Court, which at that time was a full-fledged Supreme Court, you all would recognize it quite easily, the Cherokees came in, testified, and the members of the Deer Clan stood up and said, "Molly, known to us as Jigeyu, our sister, who has ever been a native Cherokee, it would be an injustice to her and to her children, but also to the Deer Clan and to the Cherokee Nation, should she be taken away into slavery." And so what we have there is an image imprinted on paper of what it means to be adopted into the Cherokee Nation. It's not just a one-time event. It's not an event for just one person. It is an event for this person and their descendancy. It is forever. It's permanent. How many of you have ancestors that came over on Ellis Island? Okay, I'm going to pack you guys up and send you back to wherever you came from. Sound like a good deal? Doesn't sound like a good deal, does it? Okay, so if you can wrap your mind around that concept and then wrap your mind around the concept that the Cherokee Nation is a nation, just like the United States is a nation. At one time, we were on political and military par with one another. But at some point, it kind of changed, and the United States became our protector. I use that word loosely. And so, but the nature of our nation did not change. The status of adoptees did not change. They were still part and parcel of the nation, and their descendancy were part of the nation. And so in getting to my point, the Cherokees owned slaves. How many of you knew that? I mean, Cherokees owned slaves. Well, that was a surprise to some folks that I talked to down in Columbia. They were like, "What? Indians owned slaves? I thought Indians were the great environmentalists and didn't throw trash out their window." Well, got news for you. You know, we do. So the Cherokees had slaves, and as usual, we decided to side with the wrong side during a war, and we fought with the Confederacy. And during this period of time, the Cherokees lost, and we had to make a decision for ourselves. The United States gave us a couple of options: either come into the United States as citizens of the United States, give up your tribal identity, or maintain your tribal identity but adopt your slaves. Make citizens of your slaves. You have to do something, but you cannot kick them out. You can't get rid of them. You have to do basically the same thing the United States was doing. The United States had to make citizens of their former slaves, and so the Cherokees had to do the same thing. And so they negotiated this treaty with the United States. We have a principal chief who was just unelected, praise the Lord, and that gentleman didn't like the freedmen being members of the tribe. I'll refrain from calling him what I think that he is, but what his goal was to remove all of these people, about 25,000 individuals from our tribal population of about 325,000. And so he set about doing this by doing a petition to amend the Constitution. And the only reason that he was able to do that was in 1902, which was a few years, maybe 4 to 6 years after Plessy versus Ferguson. Anybody know what that was? Okay. Well, segregation of rail cars and all that kind of good stuff was okay. So segregation of the freedmen, the former slaves of the Cherokees, onto a separate section of our roll was okay at that time. Well, what that did was it set in motion the ability of this man to decide that those people were not us. They were the other. They were someone else. They were people beating down our door, trying to get our casino money. They wanted our Indian health benefits and painted them. I mean, he could have taken his playbook from Hitler. These were the enemy. They want what you have. They're the cause of our economic woes, all of these kinds of things. And so he was really good at this bully pulpit that he had. So the argument that he made was, one, that the freedmen were non-Indians. They were members of a tribe, but they were non-Indians. And everybody logically should be able to conceptualize that a tribe should be Indians, right? I mean, that makes a little bit of sense. Well, if you keep in mind that the Cherokee Nation is a nation, just like the United States is a nation, and once you let people in, kicking them out is immoral. It's wrong. It's an injustice. And, you know, you all are rebel lawyers, and I think one day, you know, you guys will be making these kinds of arguments. Well, I went around and tried to find a lawyer who was willing to defend these folks. Couldn't find anybody. You know, well, how much am I going to earn off of this? You know, what do the freedmen have to pay me? Well, how many of them are there? And each one of them could donate, you know, $25. Wasn't going to happen. And I'm not a lawyer. I'm just, you know, whenever I did this, I was a manager at PetSmart. Shows you how important it is for the average person to be able to understand law. And so I decided, well, I'll just figure out how can I get these people's situation fixed. And so I filed a lawsuit on behalf of the freedmen in the tribal court. And everybody kept telling me, you've got to prove these freedmen have blood, you know, this precious Indian blood that makes them one of us and not the other. And I refused to do that because it was not about blood. It was about the investment of sovereignty by the Cherokee people in 1866 in a document called a treaty. When we invested our sovereignty in that document, we said, I promise, from this day forward, that the freedmen who formerly had been slaves in our tribe will be citizens of the Cherokee Nation with equal rights to native Cherokees. Now, that's another legal concept that our principal chief has tried to conceal. What does it mean to have equal rights to native Cherokees? Well, if someone came to the United States and you granted them equal rights to an American citizen, what does that mean? It means that they would have the right to vote, they would have the right to live here, the right to work, the right to pass citizenship on to their progeny from that day forward. And that's what we granted to the freedmen. And that concept in 1866 was well understood by the Cherokees generally. They had no problem with knowing what that meant because they were still familiar with the adoption of Molly, the young black girl that I told you about who was transformed from being just this young black slave girl to being a Cherokee. So keep in mind, Cherokee is not a race. Cherokee is a nationality. And it is a nationality of a nation of multi-ethnic peoples. Okay, so our chief then says that the freedmen have no rights, and you know, we're arguing this back and forth in court. And we had to be able to show evidentiary that the freedmen had rights in the nation based on the Constitution. And so we argued the constitutional issues. The council had passed a law requiring Indian blood. And I have an Indian card. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with this, but it's called CDIB, Certificate Degree of Indian Blood. Those are issued by the federal government. And I have one of those. And my CDIB shows that I have 7/16 degree of Cherokee Indian blood. That means my father is 7/8, almost a full blood, even though we thought he was full blood all my life. And my mother is white. The freedmen were unable to get CDIB cards because, remember, they're on that segregated section of our tribal roll, and my ancestors were listed there with degrees of blood. Their ancestors were not, even though a majority of them have Indian blood. Are you guys familiar with the slave master creeping in the slave house? Everybody know what that's about. Well, that happened quite regularly in the Cherokee Nation. And in the documented evidence of the freedmen's ancestry, we find multiple cases of freedmen descendancy from prominent Cherokees at that time, fathering children, coming on down the line. By the time they got to the roll, when they walked up to the census taker and said, I'm a Cherokee citizen, I have X degree of Indian blood, but they had the phenotype of an African American, they put them down with no blood quantum. Cheated them out of their blood. And so that's why, in my opinion, blood really doesn't matter. Blood's not the issue here. What the issue is the investment of sovereignty. You guys understand the concept, and you know, I know you probably haven't studied a lot of Indian law, But the concept that Indian law or Indian rights are to be determined by the way that the Indians understood them. Okay, well, the principal chief tried to make the argument that it's how we understand them, how we understand them today. Sorry, that's not how it works. It's how the Indians understood them at the time the treaty was signed. And so we go back to the Treaty of 1866, and we look at how those Cherokees understood the investment of their sovereignty in that document, and we find that they said many times throughout this process, we want to adopt our freedmen. We want to make them citizens of our nation. Why? Probably because they understood that that person standing there with the black features and the hair was their great-grandson or their cousin and that sort of thing. And there's documentation of that all over the place. And so how the Cherokees understood this issue at the time the treaty was made was that those people were being adopted, given the same rights as the native Cherokees, as the Cherokees by blood. Well, our chief has made all of these alternative arguments trying to get them kicked out of the tribe. And so we continued to fight this fight, and we fought it in the Cherokee Tribal Court. And finally, in 2006, the Cherokee Court, the Cherokee Supreme Court, ruled in our favor, stating that the Constitution says that in order to be a member of the tribe, you have to have an ancestor on the roll. There's no differentiation between the sections of the roll. And that any bar to citizenship that is above what is found on the Constitution itself is unconstitutional. It's extra constitutional, therefore unconstitutional. And we made that successful argument. So the freedmen got back in. Well, that didn't satisfy our chief. He was unhappy that these people were in the tribe. And one, he made such a big deal out of it that he was afraid they were going to vote him out in that upcoming election. So he then paid his employees to go out and do a petition to amend our Constitution, to change the wording in the Constitution to require that precious blood. And so our Constitution right now says that in order to be a member of the Cherokee Nation, you must have an ancestor listed on the 1902 Dawes Roll with a degree of blood, effectively eliminating 4,500 names from the roll of the ancestors of the freedmen. So what do? We've amended the Constitution. That would be like Alabama amending its constitutions and telling all of its black folks that they can't vote. And, you know, if Cherokees had done this back then, maybe Alabama would have followed suit. Just not right, is it? It just doesn't even sound right. Okay, so what do we do? Well, we have to go to Big Brother. And who's that? The United States. And the reason that we have to go to the United States is that this treaty is between two sovereigns. It is between the United States, which is a sovereign, and the Cherokee Nation, which is a sovereign. And in that, in this dispute, the dispute is not between the freedmen and the United States, and it's no longer between the freedmen and the Cherokees. It's between the Cherokees and the United States. And so once again, unfortunately, what has happened is the freedmen voice is being silenced. They didn't get to say whether they wanted to be citizens of the nation or not, even though we believe that they wanted to. The negotiation then was strictly between the Cherokee Nation and the United States. And in the removal of the freedmen from citizenship, they were never asked, do you want to be in? Do you want to be out? All that was done was simply, you're going to go. You're going to be out. So what we have here is an unfortunate situation in which the people who are being most affected are most effectively being silenced. We're hoping that the United States Court, in their interpretation of the Treaty of 1866, will give some voice to the freedmen. They are now parties to the lawsuit. They are plaintiffs to the lawsuit. And so their voice can be heard. Whether or not they can afford to stay in this lawsuit or not, it's costing thousands of dollars to fight this battle. And it's very expensive. And the principal chief, he's no longer there, praise the Lord. And so he filed this lawsuit in court in Oklahoma. Basically, everybody familiar with the term forum shopping? Everybody know what that means? Where you look for a place that would be friendly to your lawsuit? Well, he thought that the D.C. court would be unfriendly to the Cherokee Nation, or at least fair to the freedmen, and so he thought the Oklahoma federal courts would be a better place to go. Plus, the D.C. courts had taken the Cherokee Nation out of the mix and only left him. So he was alone. The Young Doctrine says that if you are an elected official and you do something outside of the boundaries of your job description, then you can be sued. You're not protected by sovereign immunity. And so by kicking the freedman out, he was no longer protected by sovereign immunity, and he could be sued personally. Well, that kind of made the hair on the back of his neck stand up, and so he filed suit in Oklahoma and waived the tribe's sovereign immunity, unilaterally saying the Cherokee Nation will be responsible for the payment of this lawsuit. And so basically gave the freedmen what they needed, which was all the plaintiffs at the table, all the plaintiffs and defendants at the table. Everybody is there now. And so the federal court is poised within probably a matter of months to give us a decision on the freedmen. And so getting to the point of what you're here for is to hear about sovereignty and the sovereignty of Indian tribes. The sovereignty of the Cherokee people is used in ways very similar to the way the United States does. It's used internally to build roads, to provide services and those sorts of things, to protect our languages. But it's also used externally, and externally in terms of what our relationship is with the United States and with counties and with the state of Oklahoma and various things. But that sovereignty is also historic. And once invested, it's like putting it into a bank vault, and it continues to remain there until the Cherokee Nation decides that it will uninvest it and use it in some other way. And our sovereignty was invested in the Treaty of 1866. And in the investment of that treaty, this is the part I want you to remember. The Cherokees who were living at that time believed that they were making these people, the freedmen, their former slaves, citizens of this nation in perpetuity, that it would not ever end, that it would always be their right to be equal to those Cherokees who were by blood. Thank you all very much for listening to me. And let me leave you with this one point. If you ever get a chance to talk to a congressman about this issue, be sure to have him look up cornsilks.com and familiarize himself with the treaty, with the laws that surround it, and with the investment ideology of the Cherokee sovereignty. Because then they will, whenever that comes to them, they'll understand the issue much better. Thank you all very much.
And again, listeners, that was David Cornsilk speaking on a panel at the Rebellious Lawyering Conference held at Yale Law School. The title of the panel was Sovereignty and Survival, Indigenous Peoples on Federal Law and Policy. You're listening to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Ke Haolani Kawanui. Now I'm going to shift to the next segment of the show. This is the last presentation made on the Sovereignty and Survival panel held at the Rebellious Lawyering Conference. And this is a presentation made by yours truly.
Hello, everyone. Aloha kakou, valina kakou. It's really good to be here. My name is Ke Haolani Kawanui, and I want to thank you all for coming to this breakout session, and I want to thank Katie for organizing this through the PopDev program at Hampshire College, and all the people whose labor went into making it possible. I also want to thank all the Reb Law organizers. I know it takes a lot of work to put on any kind of conference, and I think this is dynamic, and it's my first time here, and I'm really glad to be here. Like my colleagues at the table, I also want to acknowledge the people of the land. Prior to colonial encroachment, all of this was Pequot territory, and the Mohegans were a breakaway group. The Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation and the Mohegan Tribal Nation are the two federally recognized tribes in this region. We're actually on Quinnipiac territory, and I want to acknowledge the three state-recognized tribes who were denied federal recognition in this last decade: the Golden Hill Paugussets, the Eastern Pequots, and the Shkatakoke. All five of these tribal nations have continuously occupied their reservations unabated since their establishment in the mid-1600s. And that's a little-known fact when people think of New England. Katie asked us each to personally introduce ourselves beyond sort of the bio in the program. And one of the things that I wanted to just acknowledge is I do identify as an Indigenous woman. I'm a diasporic Native Hawaiian, also known as Kanaka Maoli. And I want to talk to you about the Hawaiian case, but I want to set it in a broader context that's somewhat comparative with global Indigenous politics, as well as American Indian tribal status in the lower 48, and even how that's different from the Alaskan Native situation. We were asked first to introduce ourselves, explain how we came to this work. And there's just a couple quick things that I want to just reference. And one of those things is that I'm no stranger to blood quantum policy. The federal government defined Native Hawaiians through a 50% blood quantum rule in 1920 that still stands and has been enshrined. That was a federal law, and it's been enshrined in state law in relation to a reserve system that we have in the Hawaiian Islands called the Hawaiian Homelands Territory. I'm Kanaka Maoli on my father's side, and fortunately for me, in the Hawaiian system of kinship and genealogy, we can reckon our identity through the maternal and paternal lines. So you can get your Hawaiian-ness wherever you can. It's nothing ever dilutes that lineage because it's about the ancestors in ancestry, and that is about our connectivity to the larger body of other Hawaiian people, and it's our connection to the land that's genealogical. But as a diasporic Hawaiian, I know that legally there's no place for me in the law, and that's because Native Hawaiian is constrained by both the 59th state of Hawaii law and cross-cut through this 50% blood quantum. My father grew up on that territory, Hawaiian homelands, and there are small land bases across the 8 major islands. They're not on every island, but there's more than a couple bases on the islands that have them. And the place that I refer to as home and homeland is on the island of Kauai, called Anahola Homelands Territory. And I remember growing up and visiting my grandparents and my dad's siblings who still live there. My dad's one of those that left in the 1960s, and I'm sort of a quintessential Hawaiian kid, born and raised in Southern California with a white mom and a Hawaiian father. And he had military participation, which is one of the ways that our people end up out-migrating and not able to really go back in terms of the employment situation, especially in Hawaii when it was a colonial, given that Hawaii was a colonial territory after the overthrow and the illegal annexation. And I'll get to that legal story in a minute. But one of the things that I remember learning about from a very young age was being told my blood quantum. And I like your answer of how much will it take. Whenever I'm asked, and I'm asked all the time, I always say, do you work for the federal government? Like, or are you going to get me a land lease to Hawaiian Homelands Territory? Because maybe I'll, you know. And just sort of like, what does it mean? Because I often find that that's a standing question for something else somebody wants to know about me, which is really a hidden question of, do you know your language? Do you know your culture? You don't look Hawaiian. What's your tie? What's your deal? Are you urban? They want to know my class status, but they don't want to ask that. And so I find that blood becomes actually a code where people are actually trying to get to something else. And I'm like, why don't you just ask me that question if you really want to get down to it? Like, let's actually talk, because blood is a metaphor for ancestry. We're not actually talking about blood, right? I mean, if I donate a pint of my blood, is that going to mean that you're going to get Kanaka ancestry, Irish, English, and German? And I hear a little Portuguese, but I'm not so sure, right? It's a metaphor for ancestry. And so I just wanted to put that out on the table, because when you're raised from a very young age to realize that you actually don't have qualification to this land base, and you're kind of defined outside of the bounds of the law, and yet you're there visiting your family, and you know that there's a place for you there, even if there's a diasporic riff, even if there's a riff around color politics and class politics, and I'm an urban person and all that, there's still a place for everybody, and that's because the Hawaiian system is one that's ultimately inclusive. And that also includes non-Kanaka being incorporated into expansive, broad, extended ohana or family. And so I just wanted to put that out on the table. The other thing that I should mention is that in the bio, it mentions the Indigenous Politics radio show that I produce, which is syndicated. It airs on 10 stations through the Pacifica Radio Network. What's not mentioned in there is I'm also involved in an anarchist radio show that is also produced at WESU, albeit that it's not syndicated, but you can look for it. We have everything's archived online for both shows. If you go to indigenouspolitics.com, you can get 5 years' worth of programming for that show that I sole produce and sole host. But the anarchist politics show is called Horizontal Power Hour, and I work on that with a group of 10 people. It kind of goes up from 7 to 12, depending on who's around. And we work on that as a group and rotate responsibilities. And the entire podcast is archived. If you go to Horizontal Power Hour, you can get our shows there. And I mention that because I'm really informed by actually a queer anarchist sensibility is what I kind of bring to the table. And I put that out up front because I'm obsessed with the law, identify as an anarchist, and yet I'm also a nationalist. And a lot of people are like, how do you reconcile these things? And for me, what brings those together in my world is a critique of not just the state, but the colonial state. And we live in a settler colonial state. And so for me, I'm obsessed with the law. I'm not an attorney. I teach Native sovereignty politics, and I teach a bunch of other stuff. I'm just up the road at Wesleyan University. But I'm obsessed with the law. And if I had to think of like my two big inspirations, it's Queen Liliuokalani on the one hand and Emma Goldman on the other. You know, and one day I want to like imagine like a dialogue between the anarchist and the monarch, because they were around at the exact same period. So those two things are like sort of what I'm about in terms of pulling it together. We were asked to talk about what sovereignty means, both as an abstract idea and as a concrete reality shaping people's lives. And I just wanted to toss out some keywords. I've got my outline here because I'm trying to get in a lot in a short period of time, and it's going to be a bit rapid fire. But one of those is the concept of indigeneity, both as a category of analysis and as an element that has substance to it, right? Indigeneity is always about prior occupancy or original occupancy, depending on the claim being made by indigenous peoples. And it's also distinct, arguably distinct from ethnicity, race, or nationality, but it has implications for all of those. So it's, for me, Hawaiian indigeneity, Kanaka indigeneity, is not the same thing as race, right? We have a Kanaka blood quantum can be racialized, but when you go to our family reunion, we've got the Filipino branch, we've got the Puerto Rican branch, we've got the Samoan branch, we've got the Black branch, we've got the Gilbertese branch, but it's being Kanaka, it's our indigenous links that bring us under the big tent for our family reunions. And that's because we're tracing through a particular family member at that one gathering, for example. And it's our Kanaka ancestry that ties us to the land. It's not, you know, if someone has Chinese ancestry or English ancestry, that's not the connectivity in Hawaii, but there's a place for that because that's what the person actually has as well. So indigeneity is one of those things that I'm usually always talking about because indigeneity always implies sovereignty. And for indigenous nations, sovereignty is inherent, and that's what makes it distinct from the United States. The United States sovereignty is one that's appropriated and claimed for itself based on the doctrine of discovery, based on theft, right? Based on a might makes right power. Indigenous sovereignty is not based on that. It has to do with actually being of the land and being prior. Also, the concept of self-determination that resonates with what you brought up in terms of self-determination and decolonization. Those are two key words that are always at the fore for me because sovereignty is inherent, but how you exercise that sovereignty is about your self-determination. No one can actually give you your sovereignty unless they're delegating it to you the way that the federal government delegates sovereignty to the states, for example. Now, but self-determination, to me, is a key issue both within U.S. federal policy on tribal nations as well as internationally. And I want to talk a bit about international law and the U.N. Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which, again, is only a limited form of self-determination afforded to indigenous peoples around the globe. Also, the concept of settler colonialism and colonialism as distinct, right? A lot of people don't necessarily talk about settler colonialism in the United States, but it's something that has much more traction, say, in Australia or New Zealand or Canada, where white settlers actually acknowledge they're settlers. I mean, even if they're rabidly racist, they still know that they're settlers, and there's a consciousness around that. And that's because they have sizable indigenous populations and peoples, but it's also the ratio is different than the kind of multiracial demographics we have in the United States. And that's another thing I just want to acknowledge, the way you opened up, acknowledging that lineage, because I think that's what it's going to take for decolonization as a broader project for all of us to figure out a different way to relate to one another, a different way of being here, a different way of being on the lands wherever we are. And that can't happen until people actually come to grips with their own genealogy and their own relationship to settler colonialism and their own relationship to indigenous peoples, whether they came through a colonial circuit, whether they came from a circuit through forced enslavement, whether they come through being forcibly acquired, as it was with the Philippines, Guam, the Virgin Islands, and so on. And so we need to actually, for me, that's about thinking beyond the state. And what if we look at indigenous peoples as our immediate point of reference before always turning to the state? And so that's one of those things. Now, I want to just put out there, how many of you are actually enrolled in law school right now? Okay. And how many of you are two L's or L2s? How do you? Okay. How many of you have heard of David E. Wilkins' work? He's a Lumbee legal scholar. He teaches at University of Minnesota at Twin Cities. He has a brilliant chapter in one of his books, and it's called Indians Are Nations, Not Minorities. And I always want to add just the bracket, this is not merely minorities, because Indians are also minorities. But the point that he's talking about is what sets Indians, and by that he means indigenous people in the Americas, apart, in the United States context, apart from racial minorities. And there's four elements that he draws out, four realities. The first is that American Indians were the original inhabitants of what is now considered the United States. And right now I'm just talking about the lower 48. I'm not talking about Alaska at this moment or Hawaii. The second is that this pre-existence necessitated the negotiation of political compacts, treaties, and alliances with European nations and the United States. So it's that basis of prior existence that actually necessitates this political arrangement, like the treaties. And treaties are inherently always about perpetuity, right? They're always an ongoing relationship. They don't have, if it was a five-year treaty, it would just be called a contract, right? Or if it was 10 years. A treaty is an enduring document. And the third reality that sets American Indians apart from racial minorities in the U.S. is that as individuals who are part of recognized sovereigns, Indian peoples, and that's with an S on the end, which I'll talk about as well, are subject to the U.S. trust doctrine. And this is supposed to be a unique, although when the U.S. uses the word unique, you usually have to run for cover, is supposed to be a unique legal relationship with the U.S. federal government that entails protection, right? And that means protection from state governments that might want to railroad over tribes and protection from foreign nations that might want to encroach on tribal nations. Again, that trust doctrine is supposed to be a unique legal relationship with the U.S. federal government that entails protection. Now, stemming from that trust relationship, the U.S. asserts plenary power over tribal nations that, by any sort of middle-of-the-road textual reading of the U.S. Constitution, means that that plenary power is exclusive and preemptive. Exclusive meaning it keeps state governments and foreign nations out of the picture, and it has the say, and therefore it preempts those other bodies. Unfortunately, as many of you know, and some people know all too well, the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted that part of the U.S. Constitution to mean that the U.S. has unbridled, total plenary power, so that plenary power has been interpreted to mean absolute, unilateral authority. That is the contradiction, because how can you all automatically acknowledge, say, a nation as an inherent sovereign and treaty with an inherent sovereign, and then in the very next step say that your sovereignty is subordinate to mine and I can unilaterally call the shots? It's not a consensual relationship any longer, right? So that's the contradiction that we live in the United States. And that's just dealing with tribal nations. You get into Alaska Native situation and the U.S. territories in the Pacific and then the Hawaii story, and it's even more complicated in terms of those contradictions. But in terms of the Constitution, those of you who have looked at it or you've studied this know that the Constitution defined tribal nations outside of the American body politic, and that changes through federal policy over time. Now, the part that plenary power is derived from, the part of the Constitution, is in the Commerce Clause. And it's the section that gives Congress the power, quote, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And so right there you can see that the U.S. government, when it was formed, made a distinction between Indian tribes as foreign nations. That already for me is problematic, but that has to do with the new U.S. nation state, as an imperial force, colonizing tribal lands and then incorporating them, encompassing them within the U.S. broader polity, but in a very shoddy way, right, that's inconsistent. And that changes when you look at U.S. federal policy. But this was just about regulating commerce, right? And so you can see why the federal government would want to do that. So again, in tribal nations in relations to states and foreign nations, the federal government doesn't want the president of a tribal nation brokering an oil deal with the president, you know, with the king of Saudi Arabia, right? The president reserves that power for himself. And that has to do with commerce, right? It doesn't mean that Sunoco can't get in through, Venezuela and Chavez and broker a corporate deal, but in terms of actual commercial relationships between executive powers, that's where Congress steps in. But that has been interpreted to mean that the U.S. can do whatever it wants. And one of the reasons what this has to do with is the doctrine of discovery. And hopefully you all know this by now, if you've even entered a law school, but just want to mention some of the scholarly work that's been done on this. For those of you unfamiliar with the doctrine of discovery, in the U.S. it's enshrined in the first case to hit the Supreme Court that ever dealt with the Native question, although no Native people were actually party to the lawsuit, and that's Johnson versus McIntosh, 1823. And that is the first in the Marshall Trilogy. Chief Justice then goes on to rule in the Cherokee Nation v. Georgia case, and then Wooster v. Georgia. And it's those three cases, the trilogy, that set the paradigm that really sets out the template for how the U.S. is going to deal with tribal nations to this day, right? But in the Johnson v. McIntosh, it's not dealing with a particular tribe. It's dealing with the question of whether or not Native nations own their own land enough to be able to sell them. And the ruling talks about Indians being heathen, savages, and because they're not Christian, the U.S. owns all lands, ultimate title and dominion over all lands, and Indians get use and occupancy rights. But the U.S. is the landlord. Tribes are just the tenants. And even reservations, some people don't know this, even reservations, the federal government might acknowledge that the tribe has jurisdiction and limited sovereign authority over reservation, but the U.S. claims that it owns those too. And tribes are not allowed, federally recognized tribes are not allowed to even assert jurisdiction over them unless they're under federal superintendency. Right? And so if you can get your head around that one, right, you can act sovereign on this land base so long as we hold it in trust for you, right? And this was affirmed in the 1998 Venati case that dealt with the Native Alaskan village because the Alaska Native Corporation owned their own land and tried to assert jurisdiction over it, and the federal government said, no way. You can't tax the state or that school because you own it. In a sense, you can't own it yourself, and that's not good enough for sovereignty. So right there for me shows the limitations in terms of what U.S. federal policy allows for the exercise of that inherent sovereignty in the form of self-determination. But the thing around the Johnson v. McIntosh case that's super important for us today in the 21st century is that that case undergirds every single lawsuit that ever goes to the Supreme Court. And one of the things that Robert Williams has brought out in his book, Like a Loaded Weapon, is how racist this opinion is. And how when you have the Plessy v. Ferguson case that deals with separate but equal as a doctrine that gets overturned and struck down as bad law in Brown v. Board of Education by 1954, how is it that in another Alaska Native case, T. Hitton, the very next year in 1955, denying tribal sovereignty or indigenous sovereignty to an Alaska Native group, it rests on Johnson v. McIntosh. And Robert Williams says, how can you have, right after Brown v. Board of Education, yet another Supreme Court case that has the most racist language in the actual opinion? And he says, that's easy. All they do is excise the racist text and put in the long ellipses. Because, you could not have an opinion, say, that dealt with an African-American question that, said, Negroes are savages and therefore... Right, that couldn't fly, and yet we still live in a disgustingly anti-black racist state. But the court is not going to be able to get away with writing that in their opinions. And yet Johnson v. McIntosh still undergirds all these legal cases, but they just use the ellipses so that they don't have to put heathen savages. Now, I also want to acknowledge Stephen Newcomb's work in his book Pagans in the Promised Land, because what he does is decode the doctrine of discovery, which undergirds that legal case, to actually talk about how there really is no separation of church and state in the United States, because Johnson v. McIntosh enshrines the doctrine of discovery into U.S. federal law by saying that the U.S. government inherits, it becomes successor to all native lands by right of discovery. And it's like when I teach my students that, they go, wait, because even if you're going to go down that path of discovery language, how can the U.S. have discovered something in the late 1700s, right, when there were people here prior who weren't even indigenous? I mean, in addition to those who are indigenous, I should say. And part of that is, as much as the U.S. says that it's cut ties from the monarchy, the U.S. claims that it owns this entire place by virtue of that monarchical English discovery, right? So to me, that's one of those places where we just still are operating within that modality of juridical sovereignty that Foucault talks about, right? And so what that means is that all U.S. federal Indian policy rests on the fact that might makes right, and it's the U.S. sovereignty that's built on the subordination of Native nations because they're not Christian. And that comes right from the Papal Bulls. And it's the doctrine of discovery that also to this day undergirds international law, which is why indigenous peoples have limited self-determination through a declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples that passed in 2007 at the General Assembly. It's not even international law. It's merely a declaration. It's not a convention. It doesn't mean that people can't mobilize around it and use it so that it becomes customary law. But this is why the S on the end of Indigenous people was at the heart of this issue and still remains a sticking point for a lot of governments. And that is because under international law, peoples as a term means it's synonymous with nations. And it connotes rights under international law, rights to sovereignty and unqualified self-determination. And now when I say unqualified, I should put that in scare quotes because it's every nation state sovereignty is or should be qualified, except, you know, perhaps the United States, right? Because who can keep the U.S. sovereignty in check? But the idea is that you are allowed your native state sovereignty, but it's supposed to not be contravening human rights or laws against colonialism, laws against apartheid, right? So this is an issue also with Israel, right? Holding countries to international human rights standards. So self-determination is always qualified. But for indigenous peoples, it's totally qualified in a different way, which is to say that in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Article 3 says indigenous peoples have the right to full self-determination, and by that right, they freely determine their political status. And so you think, wow, they finally allowed indigenous peoples into this category that's built into the UN Charter, right, that they'd always been excluded from. And yet in Article 46 at the end of the document, it says nothing in this document should encroach upon the territorial integrity or political integrity of the existing settler states that incorporate indigenous peoples, right? And you can see why that is an issue, because if the Navajo Nation was afforded unqualified self-determination to be an independent nation state, and every tribal nation that was federally recognized was allowed full independence under international law, what would happen to the United States, right? That's a threat to U.S. sovereignty. So that's one of the limits in terms of that. The other thing I'll just say as I'm wrapping up is I started by talking about David Wilkins talking about what sets Indians apart from racial minorities, and I mentioned some of the colonies. This is an issue that deals with colonial territories as places who are not necessarily dealt with as peoples, but the people question is at issue. So, for example, Guam is on the UN list of non-self-governing territories because it's a U.S. colony. But Chamorros, as the indigenous people of Guam, also have a right to self-determination as the indigenous people of Guam. But other people in Guam also have the right to self-determination because they, too, have been colonized by virtue of being a colonial territory. So this is something to keep in mind in looking at the U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, American Samoa, Guam, and also the former Pacific Trust territories, which have nominal independence. The Hawaii case is somewhat is radically different insofar as the Hawaiian chiefly system was converted into a monarchy in the early 19th century, and the Hawaiian kingdom secured independent status under international law as a state, and a state with a capital S, not the 50th state of the U.S., but as an independent state. And that means that there's a different legal genealogy when dealing with the Hawaii question. And what you have right now is the federal push to actually force Hawaiians into a tribal model. And I think that that's a preemptive move to try and extinguish the ongoing Hawaiian question under international law. And so I'll leave it at that, and I can speak about those efforts. There's recently been a state bill that's passed to recognize Hawaiians as a First Nation in Hawaii. I don't know how the Canadian nomenclature got so far out there. But the Hawaii question for me is really at the crossroads between the rights of indigenous peoples under international law, decolonization protocols under the United Nations, as well as belligerent occupation and the laws of occupation through the Hague regulations under international law. And then this comparative issue with dealing with Hawaii and Alaska, how they were acquired, and then also the comparisons around the lower 48 state and federally recognized tribal nations. But even so, even though Alaska Native governing entities are recognized as sovereigns, the Supreme Court also says that there are different kinds of sovereigns. And so there's gradations of sovereign recognition. And on that note, I'll close. Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, that was a presentation that I made recently at the Rebellious Loring Conference at Yale Law School on a panel titled Sovereignty and Survival, along with David Kornsilk and Tim Akutsinger. You're listening to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Kehaulani Kauanui. And before I close out the show, I want to acknowledge the stations that syndicate this program, including WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, WAZU in Peoria, Illinois, KUCR in Riverside, California, WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut and Montauk, New York, WNJR in Washington, Pennsylvania, WETXLP, the independent voice of Appalachia, which broadcasts throughout the Tri-Cities region of East Tennessee, Southwest Virginia, and Northwest North Carolina, WBCRLP in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and WORT in Madison, Wisconsin. Also want to let you know about the Facebook group. You can find Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond on Facebook and join the group. You'll get bulletins of upcoming programs, but I also post Indigenous news from around the world. And in closing, I want to leave you with a beautiful Hawaiian track by Kavika Alfiche. This is his cover of Ka Uluwehi o Ke Kai. Thank you for tuning in. Mahalo.
He ho he no ke ike aku ke kai mo nanu ila mi ke alo hai i poini me ke ala o kali po a he ho he no ke ike aku ke kai mo nanu ila mi ke alo hai i poini me ke ala o kali E po ai pai ke o te hinu hinu la lai kala ke ia e mai mana he pono ke ia e li po ai pai ke o te hinu hinu la Lai kala he he ia he, mai mana he pono he ia. Ko 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 e kali mu ko, ke kawi luna na mo pula. O ia mo pula la e ho, moni e ni o ho ia ne. Ko 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 e kali mu ko, ke kawi luna na mo pula. O ia mo pula la e ho, o ni e ni o ho ia ne. Kapuana kali ipo me kali uko wabili ohe me kapahe aruni me kali ipanu kaina mai kapuana kali ipo me kali uko wabili ohe me kapahe aruni me kali ipanu. Mai poi no e la ea. Ibala ni ohela, ibala, 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 ibala,